Hello there, Luke here, just dropping in to introduce you to the gang. This time we have our latest culture file debate, Seeing Natures, recorded live at the National Botanic Gardens earlier this winter and chaired by Paddy Woodworth, who is, as it happens, right here.
Good afternoon, everybody. Thank you for coming. And thank you especially to my panel, Killian Mullarney, Jane Carkle, Melissa Colhan, and Yanni Petters. We're going to be talking about the relationship between art and nature in a very broad sense, sometimes in a very specific and detailed sense, I hope, sometimes in a very general sense. One of the things that strikes me is that for everybody who is a painter, or a sculptor for that matter, or working in the arts in any way and dealing with nature, is that there must be one central tension between the need for some form of scientific accuracy or reflecting reality and the need for aesthetic qualities, for beauty. And that's a kind of sliding scale, I imagine. Mm-hmm. But I thought I might ask Yanni, who is a very distinguished plant artist, and I'll move around the panel on this basis. How did you start illustrating plants? What moved you?
Well, I suppose it started in childhood and my mother's fascination with plants, and particularly wild plants and weeds. My mother was an organic gardener, so the garden was always full of lots of creatures and wild plants, and it was particularly the small, humble plants that she would make me aware of. So when I started painting, it was actually when I was probably in my 30s, I was drawn back to that part of my life of being close to the ground and really enjoying the beauty of the really humble plants. And the type of work I do is to try and capture the habitats and how plants grow together. So a lot of my work might be individual plants, as in botanical illustration, but would also very often be a collection of plants that relate to each other. And what fascinates me is the scientific aspect, that they're not just pretty flowers, they are amazing. You just constantly discover amazing things about weeds, and you know, they're plants that are considered humble or much maligned in times, but I really want to draw attention to them and make people aware of how wonderful they are. So most of my paintings would be, I often paint in watercolours, but I also paint on glass, which is a slightly odd way of working, but it means painting on the back of glass, and I'll do very detailed paintings of collections of flowers, or make designs with them, and everything is done in reverse on the glass, and then when the picture is finished, I mount it so that it's away from the background, so that the plants then cast a shadow. The technique is actually goes back to the Middle Ages, where farmers made icons in this way. So in a way, I'm making something that's very humble, very precious. So that would be my aim in life.
Thank you very much. Melissa, how did you begin to get into this world of illustration that you're now so immersed in?
Well, like Yanni, I started young. I used to make little nature journals and draw loads of little sketches and have lists of all the birds I saw and made a little map of where all the birds' nests were so that I could see if they were there the following year. So it was kind of a throughout the season type of thing. And there was a place near me where the hooper swans would come for the winter, and that would be great excitement. And so then I kind of forgot about all that and tried to be like a serious grown-up. And when I went to college, I studied architecture. And I just realized that I really wanted to have more drawing and just more like creative work on a day-to-day basis. And through a long like cycle of things, I ended up being an illustrator. And then now I'm also an animator. So it's kind of really nice to come back to think about the things that were important to me when I was small and how it's kind of still important, but in a different way.
It's interesting. It refers back to childhood again.
Yeah.
And would it be the same for you, Jane?
I would have grown up in the Burren and I still live there now. So really similar to Yanni, actually, where I would have taken a lot of appreciation in essentially what was on the side of the road, especially things like lichens and things like that. So my practice is with watercolour as well, but I tend to see drawing in a really reflective way, where I kind of see drawing as a way of me expressing what is almost what I can't put into words. It's the best way I can explain myself through my heart. So when I'm in the studio, I kind of am reflecting not only on my childhood of being outside, but also it's a meditative practice of preserving a very slow way of life, if that makes sense. And I kind of echo that in the practice of equally using watercolours, but in a very tight and controlled way of building up lots and lots of layers to take it into a meditative practice where I'm almost in a flow state of going completely inward and making sense and almost being quite rational in some ways. And when sometimes the turbulence of the studio is completely contained in this really calm space of doing the painting, and in the end people like what it looks like, but it's more so the practice of the reflective meditativeness, the calmness that it brings me is really special.
Killian, I know you started sketching very young indeed, I think.
Well, I started painting very young, but I think that was really a way that my mother could keep all of these young children occupied. And this was before there was a television you could switch on. She had read somewhere that Chinese children, given a paintbrush at 3 years of age, produced interesting results. And that was enough for her. So we happened to have a big white-tiled kitchen wall, and there was no shortage of poster paints. And all of us, my brothers and my siblings, we all just painted and messed around. And anything that was in any way good was left up for a few days. But the whole thing was cleaned every week or every few days. And it just became a very natural way of keeping ourselves occupied. We had no vision of it as art or anything. It was just an activity. But I think I was 12 or 13 before I... And of course, my interest in birds developed somehow at a very early age. And I had bird books that I used to draw and copy from the bird books. But I think I was 12 or 13 before I actually drew a bird from my own observations. It was a common white throat that I just got a really close view of. It was quite unconcerned with me. I didn't have paper with me, but I watched it for 5 minutes or 10 minutes. And I absorbed as much as I could. And then when I got home, I got some paper, and that process was so exciting. It was a much more interesting thing than copying a book. And also, I realized when I did it again and again that whatever bird I drew from my own observations, I understood them. And you know, as I developed, I could quite quickly start to see where the books were wrong. But they just didn't show it accurately, especially, you know, later on when I started to get serious and I was using a telescope, because then I would have had the advantage of seeing these birds behaving naturally, alive, whereas many of the illustrators of these books would only have seen a dead specimen in the museum. So they had to make up the posture and so on, and it just developed from that.
Yanni, can I take you back again then to your method of working? To what extent do you work in the field to start with?
I do love to go to the Burren every summer, and I'll go searching for orchids. And the only way to, as Killian said, to understand things is to actually draw them. No amount of looking at them or taking photographs will give you a sense of the structure. So you do have to kind of turn yourself upside down and really look at things really closely. And I really love that process of capturing through your hand, and it becomes very instinctive that your eye and your hand are constantly in association in making the marks. And one of the things, there's a lovely quote in Patricia Butler's book about botanical illustration, which says a botanical illustration fails if it lacks accuracy, and a botanical art fails if it lacks beauty. But I beg to burst those words and say we can have both. We can have beauty and accuracy. And that, I think, would say the same for Melissa's and Jane's work, that and particularly Killian's, that accuracy is super important, but it also has to speak to the viewer.
Yes.
So I think that's really important.
And you, Melissa, you working in the field as well?
Well, I worked in the field for things that wouldn't fly away. So basically all the flowers and stuff. So actually for Naturama, a lot of the flowers were drawn from the Botanic Gardens because I used to live in Dublin. I'd come every couple of weeks and just draw whatever was there, and then they'd all be there really ready for to be basically a background to all the animals and things. But I would really like to watch videos so that I could see the movements, and even though I would end up with a still image, I really wanted to be informed by the movement of the animal and understand that, or the birds, like their flight patterns and everything.
What was the process of working with a writer like?
I was very lucky with Michael Feuer, not just saying that because he's here. But me and Michael just got on like a house on fire, and he really trusted me with the drawings I wanted to do, and he had kind of pretty minimal suggestions, but he kind of let me have free rein. And I think as well, because he is an architect and then I was a beginner architect, but he could kind of see there's a different way of drawing and how I kind of had an element of that within it. It resonated with the way he draws as well, because he's actually a really good drawer.
You haven't illustrated any other books, have you, I don't think?
I am currently working on a book that I'm illustrating and writing myself, and I'm also actually animating it because it has augmented reality. And so a lot of the work I'm doing for the book is like a single image that moves, so it's not a story. And I think that I just wanted like a different experience of having a book and then to be able to imagine being in that space, to have an idea of when you're in a place, you really have to stay in it before you see anything. Like, you can't just like be flying through and then, oh, there's a bird fly past. But if you stay still in one place and then let everything move around you, you can just see all, like, even if you stay for 2 minutes, a little bird will come along, or a little shrew, or something really cute will happen. And I kind of wanted to kind of give that idea of you staying still and just observing.
Yeah. And Jane, then, you've worked with two very different authors, in that one is a poet and one is a prose writer, Anya Marie, Her Wild Embrace, and Jane Clark's Windfall, her anthology of Irish poetry. How did you find working with them, and did working with them differ in any way, the way you planned the interactions?
We kind of had a mutual respect for the object of the book and of a book in itself as an art form, and not only utilising just words, but also giving illustration its own platform, which is quite often seen as an afterthought, whereas all throughout my life, all I've ever wanted to do was to draw. So the fact that these writers would have given the art of drawing a real respect as well gave me so much enthusiasm to work with them. So for Windfall in particular, it was like a relationship of not only the words being used to illustrate a feeling and so much, but also having illustration given its own platform to not be an accompaniment to the words, but to be also another avenue to express the words itself. So one of my favourite poems was by Mark Roper. It's called Owl. So it's kind of bringing it back to the sense of whimsy tied with scientific accuracy. So in the poem, he's kind of giving the act of flight in an owl as something really divine and godlike almost. So I bring it back to when I was out walking in the burn once, I saw an owl, only once in my life, a barn owl, and it was at night time. So to see this white satellite face kind of turn towards me, it was like being a child, to see something divine and fairy-like in real life. So it's how do I encapsulate that in an illustration, that feeling of seeing something almost that made me feel incredibly small, something that was much bigger than me, and see it fly away in a moment in silence. So we kind of would plan out how it would be spaced on the page to encapsulate that big swooping feeling of silence, but something much bigger than me in nature. You get that kind of sudden realization, you go out of your body almost. So working with Jane and Anya as well, it's a collaboration, but mutual respect for each other's mediums and treating them as their own art form.
Killian, I imagine your relationship with Lars Svensson, who, I mean, you're responsible with Lars Svensson, Dan Zetterstrom, for producing what is still regarded, what, how old is the book now, 30?
1999 was when the first edition came out.
So 25 years.
It's getting on, yeah.
Yeah, and is still regarded as the peerless guide to European birds.
Yes, I wonder if part of the reason for that is that it took so long to do that no publisher wants to embark on that road again. But the relationship with the it actually started off with two authors. There was Lars Svensson and Peter Grant, both of whom at the time would have been regarded as the top of the hierarchy in ornithological knowledge. I won't say it was ever intimidating because I knew Peter very well. He was a good friend before we started working together. But I was definitely the junior partner, I mean, in terms of years as well as experience. They had much more experience than me. Sadly, Peter died quite early on in the project, so then I was just dealing with Lars. And that was okay. It's still okay, but it has had some very, very difficult periods because Lars, he's a very knowledgeable man. He's also a very proud man and does not like to be corrected.
Well, this is what I'm wondering. I mean, you're both looking at the same bird.
Yes.
But there is a feature.
We try not to argue over two small things like that, but there were some birds that I had much more exposure to than him. Seabirds, for example. He lives in Sweden. So I see all these seabirds, and they're my backyard birds. And sometimes we got into quite difficult territory there.
And would that be like sort of a to and fro of maybe six images, six texts floating back and forth to each other?
It used to be faxes. Then it became emails. And sometimes the emails would go to thousands of words arguing over something that is black and white, as far as I'm concerned, and I can show it, but there's a certain resistance. But overall, his guidance has been hugely useful. But when things are really bad, I say, okay, I'm going to do my part, you do your part. We let the dust settle, and eventually we'll both, agree to compromise a little or whatever.
There's another aspect to it, that this is a bird identification guide, so it has to be precise, it has to be useful for people to identify birds by. But I remember the very first time I talked to you, you talked about how one of your, I think you said, favourite parts of the process was the small vignettes that you produce in among the images of the birds, and very complex process, just that organization. But you also, to make it more complicated, you introduce these little vignettes of birds in with much less clarity, not the way you see them through a telescope or a long lens, not even the way you see them through binoculars, but the way you see them when you just look out into a landscape. You said at one point to me that is something you would love to develop further in your career, the kind of portraits of landscapes with birds in them, as opposed to extremely accurate and very beautiful portraits of birds.
Yeah, I've always said that that's something I'll do when I'm older.
But, long way to go yet. Yeah.
But I mean, at the time when that idea first occurred to us, and I think that was a very collaborative thing, I'm pretty sure Lars was also very influential in that particular decision. But it was really a way of relieving, when you have, five or six detailed portraits of a bird, different ages, sexes, and so on, and there's a lot of information and so on, to have something completely different that would just let the eye just drift into a little bit of imagination, a bit of the whimsy, perhaps. I think it really helps the plates visually. Sometimes there wasn't room for it because there was just so much detail, and that's something I would like to go back to, some of the plates where they really need what we call a distant view. And it just gives the reader an idea of the habitat, the circumstances, how you see the bird, and it is something I'd like to develop more, yeah.
Well, I suppose when you're seeing birds at long distance, there's a general impression of size and shape that cannot be conveyed with scientific accuracy. It's something you have to speak to something else in the brain, maybe? Yeah.
I'm not even sure it can be conveyed in an illustration either. I think when we look, even without consciously looking, we absorb so much In the same way as we recognize people we know, we recognize them in the most, you know, with the most minimal information. So our brain is constantly interpreting. And sometimes I do try and, you know, I consciously try and figure out what is it that enables me to tell that this is a Dunlin and not a purple sandpiper at 500 yards without even thinking about it. But there's something about it. And sometimes you can kind of get close to putting your finger on, okay, this is, it's the shape, or it's the short legs, or it's just some particular key that I think my brain is sensing. But of course, everyone sees these things slightly differently. Some people are much more receptive to color. Other people are receptive to movement. There's so many variables, and it's very difficult to, all you can do is try and represent how you see them and hope that that's in line with many other people.
Very interesting what Killian was saying, because I think it could be applied to all of our work, in that actually making the work, you become instinctive in how you represent the things you're representing. So, and that almost then seems to capture what we have in our distant memory of evolving with nature, that and a child is close to the ground and has and remembers all those things. And then my students would come to learn painting, and they say, oh yes, I remember being at this level to the ground, or I remember how these things look or behave. And it's like this reawakening, and it's all in the brain. Like, it's just incredible what we remember without consciously taking in the information at the time. It's just amazing what we can absorb through our lifetime, which is obviously necessary for survival, but it is fascinating. Yeah.
Does photography figure in your work at all?
I'd certainly use photographs, but I'd sketch first. And I'll use, that's an iPad or whatever is quite useful then if I'm painting something and I need to check something to remind myself. Yeah, photographs would be useful, but I try not to use them because it's much better to have the object in front of you.
So, why?
Just because I can see it better. I can get a feel for its volume and the three-dimensionality and the shadows. And I always say to my students that camera only has one eye, whereas we see things in the round, so we use that three-dimensionality to represent nature so it can jump off the page rather than being reduced to tonal planes. So, and you can see it also in Killian's work, like the birds are moving, or they're in the round. Yeah.
But presumably, especially with macro photography, you can actually see things that the eye can't see, just as you can with a telescope.
That's the danger. I might start doing microscopic stuff. I'm already using a magnifier to do everything. So,
and Jane, photography for you, is it an important part of your work?
It definitely is, like a lot of in the burn, because I'm really inspired by animals as well as plants as well. So I kind of have a disdain almost for creating all encapsulated pictures. I'm a little bit like Yanni, where I really enjoy the use of white space as well. So maybe my work is a paradox in that I like the scientific accuracy, but for them to be almost like stickers. I like them to be highly detailed, but almost they're lifting off the page. I will see maybe a fox in reality. I'll have a very certain pose, which is an equal blend of realism, but I like to have certain playfulness to the way that they twist their bodies and things like that, that perhaps aren't always seen in nature. So I might, a little bit like the Egyptians with the hieroglyphs, I'll take the leg of one, stick it on here, the head of another fox, stick it on there until it's this kind of, maybe in a picture way, grotesque. It's almost very difficult to describe what feels incredibly natural to me in words, but I'll blend many things together into a certain pose, maybe manipulate it in certain ways in my mind, and then somehow put that on the picture. So photography, I spend a lot of my time looking at images, but I very much would have immersed myself in the landscape as well. So, but a lot of these animals that I am inspired by are incredibly shy, so it's like an ephemeral, fleeting moment to actually see them. So photography, I think the internet books are incredible. I don't want to make myself seem like an elitist. You have to be outside. I think the internet is an incredible tool.
Killian, you've thought long and hard about photography because I think you found on occasions that you've been able to recognise a bird from a photograph that you couldn't have recognised with a telescope. And yet you have a problem with photographic bird guides as opposed to illustrated bird guides.
Yeah, I mean, I love photographs. I take thousands of photographs. I spend so much time looking at photographs that I couldn't deny that they are hugely important in my work. And I think my generation has benefited hugely from the development of photography. You can photograph anything now at any range, night or day, if you know what you're doing. In terms of the detailed analysis that you can subject a photograph to is often much, much more than you can in life. You can photograph a flock of 20 birds, and you can gather all of that information for later analysis in a way that you just couldn't do in the field. You might follow one for half an hour, but you can get so much more information. And the other thing is that increasingly, you know, 30 years ago, people would have been opening their field guide with an impression of a bird they had seen jumping around or flying over. Now they have a photograph. Because everyone has a phone, everyone, and so many birds are now being photographed, and that's what they're identifying. They have the photograph, and now they want to see what the book's going to tell them. If they haven't already gone straight to some kind of AI, you know, Merlin or something, which will give them a percentage accuracy and so on. So photographs are here. They undoubtedly influence how we see. And I embrace them, but I try hard not to be a slave to the camera, because I think one of the problems with photographic guides is that there's an overload of information. You know, especially now, cameras are so good. You get a photograph of a bird that's, you can see every feather, every bristle, every detail, and they're wonderful in their own right, but all of that detail can get in the way of the identification process because you're distracted by all this, what would be irrelevant detail. And I think that's why some photographic guides can actually make identification a little bit more difficult than it would be compared to a well-illustrated guide.
You've also mentioned, I think, in one of your presentations, that photographic guides tend not to show birds. This is what I was talking about earlier, where you've got, say, a second-year herring gull and a second-year yellow-legged gull or whatever, side by side. If you do that as an artist, you create exactly the same light conditions for each image. So you're comparing like with like. Very, very hard to do that with photography. So that you get, you know, you can have on a page with maybe 20 images of birds, you may have a dozen different gradations of shade within it.
Yeah.
Do you think that is making?
I think that's an obstacle. It's probably okay for people who are very experienced, familiar with the birds, familiar with photographs, because you can navigate, you can interpret the photograph without even thinking about it. But for a novice, I think it's much more difficult to extract the information you need and not be distracted by the vagaries of light or background or whatever. Fortunately, that's a difficulty that photographic guides are going to have for another few years. But I'm afraid AI is quite quickly going to absorb all of the good things of illustration, get all the information from photographs, and it's going to deliver the perfect package and make me redundant. Then maybe then I'll start doing some painting.
As you were born at the perfect time then. I think we should probably leave it there. Thank you very much to Killian Mullarney, Jane Carkle, Melissa Culhan, and Yanni Petters. Thank you very much indeed.